Hey guys, what's going on? Welcome back to the show. It is True Detective Season 3, Episode 3. This one is huge. It's called The Big Never. I can't wait to talk about this with you guys. There are so many crazy things. Who knew? Dungeons & Dragons. So much to talk about. I'll see you guys in just one quick second.
You're tuned in to AfterBuzz TV, the ESPN of TV talk. Now, let the buzz begin.
Oh, yeah, it gets me every time with that.
T-Bone.
Burnett.
T-Bone Burnett.
Yeah.
So groovy.
We should do a group cover, maybe, of a T-Bone Burnett song by the end of this. We were just talking about music.
Oh, yeah, you guys are both musicians, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yes. We can make it work. We're all musicians
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
We can all sing.
And I can things. Do like a sing-talk thing down here. That's about all I can do.
So, we're talking music. We're talking T-Bone Burnett. We're talking True Detective, and we're here at AfterBuzz TV. It's crazily enough, with this show, True Detective, this is the third episode. We are almost halfway through the season already. It's so wild. So different, the network. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's so different.
I don't know if I could take much more than what they give us, though. It's a lot.
It's just right. Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect amount.
The smolder is perfect. Guys, we're back. I got the full panel fully returning. I got the True Detective Season 1 and 2 team. I got my preacher teammate here. We're going to start right here. Nate Miller, how you doing?
What's going on, guys? I'm doing good.
Yeah, how was your first reaction to this episode? What do you think?
I liked it a lot. We're kind of picking up a little bit of steam. Things are moving a little bit forward. And again, more just like really consistent performances of these like really great characters. I'm just really enjoying the building of those characters.
Excellent. You're in the chat here, right? You can see.
I am here in the chat. If you've got any questions, comments, we make mistakes, and you want to yell at us,
yeah,
I'll be responding.
Let's keep the chat going. Exciting. Going down the line, we got Julia Carelli. She's back. How you feeling? How'd you like the episode?
Oh, I love the episode. I agree with Nate here. We're picking up some steam, and we're definitely unpacking who these characters are a little bit more, deeply flawed, but with great intentions, and I'm loving every second of it.
Yeah.
I'm in, and I have all my fluids.
Flippo. Flippo, wait, this side of the table is falling asleep straight up, so we got multiple Uptime drinks. Proudly sponsored.
Uptime.
AfterBuzz TV.
Actually, that stuff works.
You're a voiceover guy. You want to do an Uptime ad for us?
Yeah, yeah. What time is it? It's Uptime.
There we go.
This stuff is real, dude, by the way. Half of one of these, I feel fantastic.
I started reaching for my wallet when you said that. You're so good at that.
You can just spend it all out, right? Go.
Yeah.
I like the episode. I think it's great. I think I've decided that Old Hayes is my favorite Hayes.
Mm.
I think he's... That whole thing with what I told you put me in a home, I'll off myself.
Yeah.
I was like, yes, tell him. I think it's great, and the dynamics are growing between the characters. We're getting to see more and more, and they're starting to have a little fun.
Yeah,
which I don't think we had much of for the first two episodes.
He's literally every single child's nightmare what their parent would be, and he is every person's vision of what they will be.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, he's like,
right on.
That's
line,
exactly right.
That
right
line
on.
Is like, we all want to say that line someday, have the balls to say it to your kid, but like, yeah, I mean... I don't know.
No, you're 1,000% right. We're like, no, I'm not doing that, but you, Dad, you're going to do that.
I also love, like, he's got, like, this is really interesting. He has that line where he's talking to the doctor in that scene, and he's like, I know my son loves me, doctor, but thanks for walking me through that.
And awesome.
What's funny about that line, what I loved so much about it, was the doctor says that, and my initial instinct was like, kind of like a weird and inappropriate thing to say to this guy. Like, you don't really know these guys. Like, you know your son loves you. Well, like, I don't know. Love's pretty complicated. What if he, like, doesn't really love him? What if they have real issues? And it's like, you're saying that. And then he's like, he responds to him quite literally. You know? Like, he's like, I know what's going on. You don't have to talk to me about my relationship with my kid. It has nothing to do with my sickness.
I think the best part about getting to be old, I'm looking forward to, is being able to say whatever the hell you want.
Yeah,
and right. It doesn't matter. And I that's one of the things that they write for Hayes, I think, which is great. Like, old Hayes says what he feels like saying, and that's it. And the other two are contained or, you know, a little bit of by power structures and whatever's going on. But old Hayes is like, nah, I don't care. I'll say whatever.
So, good episode. I think my thoughts are it's starting to pick up right at the point that I think it needs to. I think with this show, what I've noticed, and a lot of these shows that have 8 episodes, 3 is a really important pivot point. Because if it doesn't start to really, like, roll downhill at 3, then you're struggling. Because then you're looking for way too much at the turn, right? Like, 3 is exactly, gives you the feeling that you have a lot of show left still.
Yeah.
It's now you're invested, right?
Well, I mean, we spoke about directors last time, and I think it's worth noting that Daniel Sackheim directed this episode, who's also the guy who directed the last 3 episodes.
Yeah.
So, that's, you know... I think that there's a reason for that, and I think that we kind of felt that we're getting a lot of the seeds in this episode that are going to lead us toward the end.
So one of the things they employ really well, and I think we'll jump around a little bit as far as the topics themselves go, but one of the things that I love is you get the same payoff you got in the first season where eventually you see Marty and Russ meet back up. And I think in that show it's a little later in the season, yeah. but like it's a nice right. payoff in this one. You see them at the bar and you see that rapport come back. And you, even though you haven't totally gotten into the real meat of the case in 1980, you still get the feeling they went through something really important together. You know, they had some really, like, significant times together. So that ability to, like, kind of give each other shit.
Yeah.
And like, be kind of, like, just, you're, like, drunk in the middle of the afternoon, and he's helped this other guy get clean, so he's got his shit together way more than you at this point. But there's still a mutual respect of, like, you've come to this bar to find me. I appreciate that. I'll give you some shit, but I still want to work with you. And he's like, you're a drunk at a bar, but I still want to work with you because I know you're a damn good cop. I love that.
I'm really happy to be finally introduced to 1990 Roland West. Because we've had yes. a lot of Hayes in all three different time periods, and I'm really understanding his transition through these decades. But I was really kind of wondering, what's going on with West? They've alluded to him here and there, and to finally see him, see what he's accomplished. Am I mistaken? We haven't seen him in 2015 yet, though, right?
No, I don't think so.
Okay,
no.
So that's, you know, that's another present that's still to come, to see what's become of him.
I got to say, I love a wig-free Stephen Dorff. It makes me tremendously happy.
I mean,
I don't like the wigged Stephen Dorff. The wigged Dorff.
Wigged Dorff of the West.
Wigged Dorff of the West. And I love that he was rocking the Pontiac, the IROC Firebird.
Yeah, that's a good car.
Damn right, man.
I mean, he's a badass.
Absolutely.
Can he ever do anything that's not just a little bit badass?
No, because he's got some stank on him. Yeah, he's just born with stank.
He's got a little swag.
I mean, he was a young hotshot vampire, you know?
Sure was.
From here on out, everything.
I wonder if we're going to get through an episode without referencing Blade.
I don't think anybody having a conversation about this show
no.
and Stephen Dorff will ever not reference Deacon Frost.
I think no, that's why he did this show, so that after this he can start doing more things and people can be like, oh, he's that guy from True Detective instead of
oh, it'll
the
flip.
Guy from Blade.
Yeah. It'll flip. I got you.
I mean, so far, he's given a killer performance.
The question is, what's the most memorable part? Is it him as a character, or is it the Snipes line, some motherfucker's always trying to ice skate out of you? It's one of those two things. I'm not sure which one it is, but they're both great. So.
Okay, so like you said, we weren't sure. I was not even sure that they were going... I didn't think that they were going to reconnect in me. I thought that we were only going to get the two of them in the 1980 timeline. So I was really pleasantly surprised when he walked in and was like, oh, by the way, I'm starting a task force. I was like... hell yeah.
And I'm a lieutenant.
Yeah. And I mean, and like you said, seeing him, like, obviously we saw him
yep.
with the guy, with Tony, going back, you know, to tell him the news that that his daughter might be alive. Which
is it Tony or Tom?
Tom. Sorry.
Right. Yeah.
Mr. Purcell.
Yep, Mr. Purcell.
And, yeah, I mean, clearly, even just from looks alone, you can tell that he has changed a lot from when we saw him in 1980.
That was a stark Tom. Contrast. Yes. I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he difference. Said that he was sober for 5 years. We find out that Lucy died.
Yeah,
In Vegas.
Yeah, in 1988.
Fill in the blanks.
Yeah, so there's a lot of information that we got there, but also even from Roland's perspective too, seeing how much that he has changed as well, and he's, you know, very clean where we see him now, much more put together than in the 1980 timeline, and also he's got this job and this authority. We see that he's been recognized for his work.
And you start to... So there's some things mentioned here in the scene. So the first one I want to talk about is before we go into that bar interaction. It's a big part of the show. Is mm-hmm. that you're talking about when he goes to see Tom in the trailer. Right. It's kind of a trailer. It's like a really nice trailer.
It's really nice inside. Trailer.
Yeah.
It's like, a huge kitchen.
It's like a fancy, fancy trailer. And he says, 5 years ago I got sober and it was you that helped me. And you're like, okay, so you were working on this case... Somewhere along the line develops a relationship that's important between the two mm-hmm. of you guys beyond what we're seeing so far.
Mm.
Yes. And on top of that, somewhere along the line is there was something crazy that happened that we're going to have to witness that gets him to this point, right? Like, he looks like he's a totally changed person, right? And in some way, Stephen Dorff felt the need to invest. And also, there's a line that Mahershala says, if I had taken a bullet, I'd be right. playing golf.
Yeah.
So somewhere along the lines...
my friends.
In this first...
Roland gets shot somewhere.
Yes, somewhere in the 1980 yes. timeline, the Steve McQueen dying timeline.
Between 1980 to 1990,
He gets shot, and that's a thing that we're going to witness. And so I'm curious what's going to happen there. Now, another thing I wanted to bring up is, and this is really distinctly different in this season than what we've seen before. Season 1 has two white detectives, right? Season 2 has 4 white detectives. This is the first time you're seeing any reference to race within the two main characters, And it's referenced in the first episode. We didn't talk about it when he says the line about talk to them. They're your tribe, mm-hmm. right? It's a super significant difference in the way that they're treating the people they're interacting with. Like, even though you can tell in the first timeline, Mahershala is clearly more qualified as a cop. He's way better at his job, right? He's a tracker. He's super smart. He's doing everything.
And saner, it seems.
I don't want to say that because, I mean, based on what we've seen already, I feel like I don't think Hayes would be a really effective cop on his own. He needs Roland to kind of, like, pull him down to earth. And Roland is the one who is, like, talking to people and, like, empathizing with people. And that's why he forms that relationship with the dad, whereas Hayes is more of a factual... He's the hunter. This is what we got to do. He's much more abrasive, much less sensitive when he's dealing with people.
Might be worth considering that the reason for that dynamic is because of where they are and when they are. In the 1980s and the 100%, Ozarks,
of course.
I mean, are you going to get more mileage as a cop trying to get your witnesses to talk, whatever you need, by having the white cop talk to the white folks?
They both understand. There's that moment in the bar reality. That we talked about in last episode that we just did, where he's talking to Amelia. He goes, "How is it for you? No, really, how is it for you?" Mm-hmm. Talking about being a person of color in this small rural town in that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's that difference. And then even, as we find out at the bar later, he's, when he tells him, "Why didn't you tell him you were fixing up Jeeps while we were getting shot at?" Also, the dichotomy of the experiences that they had coming back from the war, one of them was in a much more dark, gritty situation than the other one. So they have there's a lot of different things at play with two of them that make them this great combination, which is why I think they're going to be able to make break on this case that a lot of people wouldn't be able to.
I don't think that they could exist without each other because of their separate skill sets that make each other stronger.
Exactly.
But when it comes time in that day and age for a promotion, perhaps, yes, he was overlooked because of the pigmentation of his skin, which he brings up.
He also makes a comment, too, about being a big mouth.
Big mouth. He said something at some point. Yeah. We haven't seen it yet. But he's got to come out.
But he's drinking a lot.
Well, even...
Yeah. A lot of drinking going on. Yeah.
Well, we find out that he's not a detective anymore. Hayes has been working a desk job, mm-hmm. which is... I mean, it's implied that it's like a demotion. And even with his demeanor in his initial sit-down... It doesn't seem like his relationship with the rest of the law enforcement is very good. Like he definitely feels like he was screwed over, and so then to see Roland on the other side, not only still a detective, but then to get promoted to a lieutenant of the state police and now to lead a task force, it's just a really interesting.
But he seems to understand too, because in his interviews that he says to them, pardon my language, but he says, you really fucked over a good detective, or something along those lines. Like he knows that they were possibly both deserving, or mm-hmm. they should both be on same level.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But he knows it, and he's not afraid to say it because that's his friend. And then he says, "When we stopped working together, we stopped working," which makes me. Informs to me that they can't really exist without each other.
Yeah, he says, once we stopped working together, we just stopped.
We just stopped.
Yes, that's it. You're right.
I think there's also, and you see this a lot with writers that kind of work in like darker spaces, but there's a commentary on addiction here, right? Like it's clear between the two characters.
Yeah.
You're seeing one character who is a mess, who gets clean, and all of a sudden just his face looks better, his whole situation, right? He's doing his thing. And you look at Hayes, and it kind of seems like there was a point in this story where he's kind of the hot shit guy. He's the one who discovers the body. He's the one who's making the big breaks on the case. And it's kind of going downhill as he's drinking more and more. So you pick back up in 1990, and at that moment, you've got this guy who was a mess who's gotten clean, and now he's doing it. And the other guy is kind of falling off a cliff. He's drinking at noon at a bar. And I think it's important to remember because it's a definite commentary that you're seeing here, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see more of it.
And remember that that scene takes place after the whole Walmart fiasco too, so it's and he also has this disagreement with Amelia when she comes home. And I mean, I think he had a reason to be upset, but there's clearly something else that was playing there, and that's why he reacted in that way.
Yeah,
and so it's more than just the drinking; like it's affecting all parts of his life. It's like almost consuming him.
Again, back to their drinking, and to harken back again to that meeting in the bar between he and Amelia, she asks him point blank, "Do you drink a lot?" And he says something like two times or three times a month, I get drunk because I like to laugh, which I thought was kind of comical. It's like, you do?
We haven't seen that
you
yet.
You like to laugh?
Right.
And also to anyone who drinks, if you like, does he mean he gets hammered three times a month?
Right.
Or
define
does he mean that he has drinks three times a month? from what we're seeing in the amount that he drinks, it seems like he means he drinks every night, but he gets drunk three times
a week. I feel like a lot of that, though, came after this case.
Maybe.
Because if you look at a lot of how he acts in the 1980 scene, it doesn't – he's just much more put together, and he just seems much more frantic in the 1980s. And then in the 2015, obviously, he's much more apart because he's
You wonder when his mind started to break.
They also didn't say what – disease was?
We can say quite certainly what, quite almost certainly what you have.
Yeah, Alzheimer's disease. Got to mention Alzheimer's, obviously, right? You would think, right?
I would think so.
That seems like the implication. They did take a CT scan.
I like very much what you said about addiction, because I think we're one of the things we're overlooking in the show is that everybody's smoking all the goddamn
time. All the time.
It's so jarring now, to me anyway, because it's just not, when we were kids growing up, everybody smoked on TV, because not because necessarily everybody's addicted or the characters, it wasn't even sort of thought of the character. It just something to do with your hand, and it looked cool. So, and it's neat now to see, like, now if you're smoking on TV, it's a choice.
Yeah.
Why are we doing it? We're doing it for a particular character choice, and it's a real thing. And, you know, it's funny, that scene with Tom, right? I'm clean and sober for 5 years, and he's smoking a cigarette and pouring himself a cup of coffee. Like, all right, well, you know, you still got your hooks.
Got our vices.
I think to a degree, like, also just because of the reality, I think often we're going to see that just because a lot of people were smoking at the time. Like,
it's way more
weird
it's the same. I mean, that's kind of the same point about the dealing with race in the show, right? It's just the time thing. It's 1980. So I want to talk about the relationship between Hayes and Amelia. I think it's important. But before we get there, that's the next topic. I want to remind everybody here that we are the ESPN of TV Talk. We have been. We're very thankful for you guys continuing to make us the ESPN of TV Talk. We cover almost every show on TV. It's over like 150 shows that are covered on AfterBuzz, been around forever. Big thanks to Maria and Kevin for starting this thing for us and giving us a place to talk about television. If you want to help us out, give us a rating and a review on iTunes. Just leave us a review. Write your thoughts. 5 stars. It helps us stay high in the standings so people can find the show. If you're watching on YouTube, subscribe, comment. We'll share your thoughts next week on the show. Thank you guys so much for listening and watching to AfterBuzz. Let's go. All right, so their relationship. Something super interesting happened in this episode, and it was that she comes home, she's drunk, she's talked to this cop, she's gotten dinner with him, and she's doing exactly what she told him she might do in the car, right? She's going to get all gussied up, she's going to go ask questions, and he's like resisting to her involvement, right? And it seems like early, you don't really catch that maybe he wasn't that thrilled about the fact that she got involved in the stuff. She's kind of pushing her way in, right? Like, she helps him get the break in the first place in 1980, right? She finds the thing about the doll. But then she's writing these books, and she's sitting with him, and it's like, she's pretty good at this stuff, but she wants to write books. She's not a cop. That's what she's doing, right? She's doing something else.
But she's glamorizing it, and she's thriving on it, and it makes her like sexuality come out a little bit, and she gets to be something she's never been before and be gregarious and wear a bra and have her hair down and all flirting with the detectives and go out to dinner and have drinks with them. I was like, okay, Amelia. That's what we're doing.
It was straight up jarring to me. Like, it must have been cold in the detective's office, man. My goodness.
The nipples? Oh, yeah.
Gee whiz.
Definitely.
And what a choice. I mean, it's like, it's such a specific choice.
She got what she wanted.
Right? But I don't know. I wonder how much of his frustration with that particular scene, I guess, is the way she went about it versus versus her involvement. And then at the end of it, when she came back drunk, that I mean...
We can all relate to that, right? We've all had somebody come back, and you're kind of serious. You've been worrying about something. Like, you feel like they've dropped the ball, even if it's like you knew they were going to. And you're worried, and they come in, they're in kind of a good mood, and you're like, shut up! Stop being drunk!
Right? Stop being happy and drunk and confident, and I'm shitty.
Well, I think even deeper than that, too, I think it's just a really... You know, I don't know if this is intentional, but I see it almost as like a similar metaphor to the... experience that the viewer has, where like for us, all these clues and finding the body and all this stuff, it's exciting. There's all these things going on. Whereas for him, he found the body. He took the pictures. He looked for the girl. He tracked the clues. A bunch of other stuff has happened too, which apparently is really bad, and he wants to block out and forget. So for him, it's a much different experience. So for her to be having fun or like drunk and like. And she's like enjoying the moment because she's doing this investigating thing. And for him, it's not, he's not enjoying it. This is something he has to do because it's tearing him apart.
Inside. Right.
I agree.
It's
completely
keeping him up. So for him, I think it's a lot of that other stuff, but I think at its core, it's this kind of like two completely different sides of the same coin.
Completely agree. And that's why I think he says, don't talk to me about this shit. And she says, you know, I'm talking like that. And he says, or, you know, you can say it. And he says, it's been said or whatever. Like, that's why his approach is bad, but his point is sound, which is like, you're using this to write a book. Even right. if it's creative, you're like profiting off of the situation in some way.
This is a lark
way.
For you, and for me, this is deadly serious.
This is my job that I hate, but it's like eating me up, and I'm sitting here. And who just drinks straight Jack Daniels? I mean, I gotta say.
I've done it.
Don't get me wrong.
Well, before I...
done it.
Let me ask you guys
discovered
this.
What good whiskey was.
Yeah, like anything other than Jack Daniels. Yeah, I mean, that's rough stuff. 22. No ice.
Do you guys think
Amelia
might be making more money at this point? I mean, it seems to me if she's publishing books...
Well, this is her first.
Is this her first?
Yeah, so I don't think she... Well, now she's amending it because now Julie might still
out
be out there.
Is it her first? She tells the cops that she's done a couple books.
Oh, really?
Does she?
I always wonder.
Oh,
I thought that was her first,
and then six more came out. I could be wrong.
It could be. That's an always interesting thing to find out. When your relationship, the money changes in the relationship, the dynamic changes.
Right.
So if that's part of it, too, then that could be playing into it.
Yeah, it's true.
If all of a sudden she's making a whole bunch of money and he's been demoted and riding a desk for the last 10 years and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, you see him sitting there just drinking straight Jack, which is like... It's the dynamic
just
is changing.
Just funny when he's so pissed at her for being drunk. He's obviously drunk, just sitting there getting drunk.
Sitting there getting drunk, right.
Yeah,
exactly.
But they're drunk for different reasons. One was fun and frivolous, and one was to drown your sorrows.
Also, that part of their relationship was, I thought, very relatable to a lot of people. Like, that interaction is an interaction.
Oh, God, yes.
Whether or not there's alcohol involved, I think most of us have had an interaction like that at one time or another, which I always like when scenes like that get written because they hit home.
Yeah, it was really real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, super real. And you're like, he's angry at all these different things, and it's coming out in this
right.
way.
And
it's kind of ugly.
At her, yeah. And you see that she, like, even for a while, she loves him and knows him so well that she kind of, like, tries to play it off and then eventually realizes, like, no, this is where we're at. We're angry now. And she's like, all right, cool. Fuck
Do you guys think she's justified in, like, flirting with cops and not even going to the point of having dinner with a cop?
Well, this is always a thing, right? So if you can sit out, and I like the way they did this because they made it deliberately... They didn't make it simple and easy, right? So you go in there, and you could go in there with your white blouse or white dress, and you could be wearing a bra, and that's definitely a choice. Or you can go in there with enormous nipples, and that's also a choice. And I think that having it be that choice, and then having her go to dinner with the detective, which arguably she didn't need to do.
Yeah, right.
What else is she going to get out of it? And he was, I mean, clearly the body language, he's literally all over her. And instead of her going, you know what, that's enough, she's like, this is kind of fun. Yeah, let's finish it out, you know.
And she's saying my ex-husband, so she's clearly lying now.
She's laying it down. But that was part of the plan, right?
Yeah, make her seem single and available.
But it's interesting then there's that moment, right, where maybe she's having a good time with it. And it's relatively harmless. She's not going to do anything with it, but...
I think what Julia said is correct. I think she is. And I think you even see, like, they're sitting looking at this Walgreens, you know, trying to figure out what to do at the beginning. She's like, we can go drink and have sex all night. You know, she's into it. It turns her on.
Yeah, she's totally into it.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, the whole experience seems to turn her on, which is obviously... And they're starting to kind of lead us in. Now,
well, that's how they got together. I'm sorry. Last thought on that. That's how their relationship...
Started.
Became a relationship. That's their shared experience. And that seems to be the only experience... I mean, yes, they have a family and things change, but this seems to be the common thread throughout their entire 10 years of a relationship. What else do they have?
So now, continuing to talk about their relationship in this episode, I think... And to me, at least, this is the most jarring part of the episode, is the weird psychological flashback thing where he's sitting there. The basically horror movie segment of this episode where it started to happen. And I don't know if you guys felt the same, but I felt it was creepy as hell. I mean, it was getting to me. Like, just like her being young and saying this stuff. And some of the lines, there's one line she says, past, present, and future are a stubbornly persistent illusion, right? That's the one that stuck with me because it starts to really tie together the three timelines in a way that you're like, okay, so what am I watching? How much of this is all memory, and then how much of this is really happening, right? So it's the unreliable narrator stuff we were talking about last episode.
Yeah, the few quotes that I noted down were when she says, "Do you think you could just go on, and did you think you would never have to look back?
What you left out in the woods?"
She says, "Where is it?" He says, "Where is it?" Which I don't know what he's referencing to. And then he says, how much do I have to lose? Which she says, everything, like everyone else. And then she says, worried what they'll find, what you left in the woods, finish it. which is super cryptic.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And creepy. And you, and then you start to wonder. You're like, so what happened? Is that what's driving him to drink in the middle of the day?
Well, it's also like, what does Amelia know, too? Because we know that he hasn't read the book up until, like, 2015 is when he starts reading it. And it even says in 1990, when he's, like, trying to read it, that he can't because he keeps seeing his name. And that goes back to that conversation that they had when they were walking, talking about the interpretation of the poem, where for her, the interpretation is – you know, you don't say the name because once you say the name, then you associate yourself.
You separate yourself you separate from something yourself, when you
right.
name it.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And you can't separate yourself from time, right. which to me you brought up in the last episode about, you know, all these tying together, time being a flat circle. It's all just sort of melding together a little bit in my mind, these ideas of time.
So now I think moving from that topic to the other one, which is really interesting, which is there are some fan maybe we'll save that that part of it. But let's talk about him finding the dice, the set of die, the die that Nate and I as giant friggin' nerds.
All right. Okay, yeah, I'm gonna remove myself from this part. I'm just gonna let you guys talk about this because I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
My nerd level's like a six yeah. and a half.
So I go think boys. Where
you
guys,
oh boy!
If to get those die, you guys don't. We had to pause it and go back while these guys counted the die and we're like, what die are in there? And we're
I was like, Nate, did you see? I saw four, three, I saw 10.
D20.
Jules and I are like, yeah, there's dice, man.
Dice,
they're
right?
just dice.
Right?
They're like, and the look on his face. I don't know if you saw it. Like Ben's face, like there was a moment of contempt for us, and then he covered it up real quick. And like, oh, I was like, don't know anything.
He was like, yes.
Are you sure it was a D20? He's like, yes, I saw 19. I was like, crit.
All right. Can you give us a little background on what the heck
please,
this means?
Please, upgrade our nerddom.
Yeah. I'll let you take this one away for all right. D&D stuff.
Well, okay, thanks. I'll take the bullet. yeah, so we see those die. More often than not, you don't see a D20, just a 20-sided die outside of Dungeons & Dragons, which is what D&D is, if people didn't get that. So the reason why I got excited when we saw the die was because, I don't know if it was episode, I think it was episode one, yeah. So. When they're searching Charlie's room, there is a D&D book on the desk, which is called The Forest of Lang. Now, granted, I am a big nerd, and there's lots of other big nerds on the internet. I read a lot of Reddit, so if you post on Reddit, get at me. I'm going to read all your theories. But somebody on Reddit was talking about how that's not a real book. That's not, you know, so they had to make that. So that really stuck out to me as something important. I still don't know what it means, but seeing the die reinforces that the fact that he plays Dungeons & Dragons is, in fact, important. So one of the questions that we got this episode, learning about the kids in this new spot where they were hiding and the mixed couple and the brown car and all that stuff, is that the Boyle kid, they were not hanging out with the Boyle kid after mm-hmm. school. They were doing something else. So this implication that they were going to play Dungeons & Dragons out there, that explains what those other toys were doing there. Often when people play D&D, they use miniatures and stuff. It makes sense for kids to use their own toys. And especially these are a bunch of toys that the parents never saw or purchased. So we're wondering where those came from. So it's a lot. It's just more questions, of course. But just another lead that I feel like is going to lead somewhere important.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was a Nate deep nerd dive.
Deep cut. So I will tell you, I'm not a Dungeons & Dragons nerd, but I play a significant amount of Magic the Gathering.
Oh, I did too back in the day.
It's way nerdier.
I don't know what this is either.
It's way nerdier.
It's a collectible card game. Yeah.
Guys, I was super cool doing musicals.
Yeah,
yeah, okay?
There you go.
Musical theater. I was really cool.
So you get a spin down.
Don't worry about it.
You can do both.
You get a spin down, which is a 20-sider when you play Magic at like an event. They'll get one. And so I have a lot of these. That's basically a 20-sider.
It's a life counter.
Yeah, it's a life counter. Exactly. They call them spin downs, okay? I was playing earlier today and I got a new spin down for the new set. Okay, let's move on. Anyway.
Oh, the nerd. It's a very strong nerd table.
Strong
right
nerd table.
Where am I?
So that's a significant part of the show is the book, the fact that he finds the dice. That's a theme I think we're going to continue to see, and it's going to kind of connect us a little bit to the weird, culty, supernatural dolls in the woods stuff that reminds us of season one. Stay tuned at the end of the episode. We are going to talk a little bit about that and some of the theories that go with the season one stuff. I want to talk quickly about our Vietnam vet garbage collector who gets accosted. Uncomfortable scene.
Yeah, that was a hard one to watch.
Whose side are you on this, guys? Do you think he's innocent and he's getting hassled? What do you think?
I think he's innocent.
If feels like.
Although that bag looked very child body like.
Well, I think it's supposed to, but I'm pretty sure it's filled with long guns.
I don't think it is.
I think it's full of guns. Well, we know that Julie's alive, and we know that they've already found Charlie's body. So
we don't know that Julie's alive. We know that her fingerprints were found.
Yeah, that's
we
true.
Find that later. Yeah, we don't know at that point.
It would be pretty weird if they were just
But we also know that he doesn't know where his kid. He says he doesn't know where his kids are.
Right.
I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yeah. Well, he said that
it's
in
morbid.
The
morbid. I know. I'm just going to throw it out there.
He said that in the interview because he said his wife.
His wife
took
has
them
the
away.
Kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure, she did.
I don't. Like, it's
or
a
he killed him and is hiding him in a bag.
No, I think it's like a bag of guns or something.
I think so too. But
it would make sense.
I don't know about you guys. I grew up in L.A. It's a big town. There's not, like, vigilante justice is really not a thing. Like, you don't do that because you go to the police and there's, you know. But I would imagine, you know, if you're out in the... Well,
people just don't care enough in L.A.
It's a very bizarre place. But imagine if you're out in the middle of, you know, wherever, and you know, you're looking for the state police to come through if anything major crimes happens. Yeah. And, you know, it's a much smaller place. Then maybe that is how you deal with things.
You take matters in your own
hands.
You get three or four trucks and you go chase them down.
Everybody more or less knows each other, and you have the news talking about missing kids, and they're going canvassing houses. So people are scared. And, they're scared for their kids. And when everyone in the neighborhood knows that there's already, like, that one weird guy,
the Boo Radley.
And I'll tell you what.
It's always Boo Radley.
That's the 1980s version of the Megan's Law list right now. And as soon as someone's on that stuff, like I live up in Santa Clarita. It is a bedroom community, and it's all kids. And if someone that is on that offenders list moves up there, they make a stink about it. They will put them on. They'll put them in the paper. They'll get on. They'll march around.
Try to shame
it,
them.
Yeah. Get out. We don't want you. I mean, it's you know, so this is the 80s version of it in a small town. I don't know whose side to be on that one.
Yeah, I mean, the Vietnam Vet thing we talked about last episode, it was a lot of people were creeped out by these, like, sort of, like, loner, you know, kind of quiet. We, like, you know, people, like, a lot of PTSD. It was a thing. So last thing I want to ask you guys about before we kind of wrap up in the last bit of the episode
is... Oh, my goodness. It's over already?
Yeah. There's so much to talk about.
We've got Steph Sabrop in the booth. Steph, how you doing? Didn't you hear us?
Maybe.
Maybe Steph is not in the booth.
All right.
We've been left alone. Maybe we can go a few minutes longer. What I want to ask you guys about is they go and visit this guy. He says he's been talked to by this guy in a brown sedan. And so...
I don't think the brown sedan is the car that he saw driving.
Sorry, he saw
a
brown
an
sedan.
Upscale.
And he was talking to
some white man in a suit with a badge.
With a badge. But he sees the brown sedan and he sees a black man and a white woman driving around the neighborhood.
Black man
and,
with a scar.
Yep. And so, and this is information that is getting also relayed in this conversation that's being had with Elisa, who seems to know. He seemed like he had a slightly more personal relationship to Hayes' son. Am I wrong about that? They seem to know each other better.
The way that they said each other's first names.
Yes.
To me, I read that as they know each other
more than it seemed in the first episode.
Yeah.
You're right. Mm-hmm. So that all that information is happening though, and they go to see this guy, and they ask if they can look in his place, and he's like, "You need a warrant for that." And he said, "If you make us get one, I think you're gonna have to, son." So is that guy? What's going on with that guy?
Well, I think everyone in that town, their invasion or their privacy has been so invaded. When they were gonna canvass the neighborhoods already, they said that they would make a big stink about it.
Right.
That people wouldn't want the cops coming into their homes uninvited without warrants. So I think that's just sort of, get out of my house.
Yeah.
I didn't do anything wrong. It's not your place. I just keep to myself. Some guy was already here and questioned me. Enough.
I also feel like race plays a role in that one. I absolutely.
Definitely.
You know, because the condescension in the guy's voice. You know, I think that was... that
he calls him son.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, it's half a step from boy. I mean, you know, I think that was... This is going to be a red herring. I don't think it's going to have anything to do with him. But I think that just it's a good little... what you call it? A little flavor for the time.
Yeah,
like it definitely mattered that you were. White
I definitely
or black.
Gave him some good information through that.
Yes,
scene.
Oh, yeah.
It may not pan out to anything, but
I mean, Pizzolatto is a fascinating writer because he investigates his topics like almost nobody does. Like he really does. He will go such the extra mile in terms of his preparation for his scripts and also the films he's written. And with this one, he's taken all this extra time to make it clear to us the time in terms of the relationships between, like, you know, race in a small town, the relationship between even the conversation when they're walking, and he says, funny how the protesters stopped once the draft ended. Like,
oh yeah,
even just the commentary on Vietnam soldiers in that moment. It's like, so he's trying to really put us in these characters' shoes in that time period. He doesn't want it to feel familiar. But I do have to tell you guys, I think I caught one inconsistency. I could be wrong about this, but I work in the toy industry, and when they're in Walmart, on the end cap, there's like this big thing of rainbow-colored balls. Did you see those?
I did.
They literally are the same Headstrom balls that are for sale today. And unless it's the exact same Headstrom balls that have been selling for 25 years in Walmarts on end caps, which is possible, by the way, I was like, those are new. That's literally for sale right now.
And you want to have Walmart does that? Every year, Walmart wants to underbid that. It's a tough thing. There's a friend of mine's in buying. It was wild. They were talking about those balls specifically, because if you sell X number of those balls, Walmart the next year will be like, all right, we're going to sell 15% more, but you got to drop the price.
Headstrom costs nothing. Yeah.
Tough scene. But you might be right, yeah.
Didn't know the ball industry was
who
so
knew?
Cutthroat.
Yeah.
Rainbow balls.
Throat, Jack.
Got to get into the underground market.
I still play with those at the grocery store.
Do you ever buy one or just play with them
just
and throw them back,
back in the basket?
Yeah, so anyway, so I think that's all pretty interesting stuff and how specific he is with what he writes. So
bring up one
I've
thing real fast? Those little notes.
Oh, man. Okay, yeah, go
the
ahead.
Little notes in, Julie's notebook. The notes that were all folded up. I'll always keep you safe. Don't listen. Have a good night in the Hoyt. And the Hoyt Foods bag.
Yeah,
I guess that and the picture. We have to talk about both of those things, right? Those are both pretty significant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, found the picture from the communion photo. I wasn't even going to say anything about that because I think it's weird, but it doesn't mean anything to me yet. I think we're going to get, especially from the next time on, they're going to talk about that a lot next episode, but I just don't, like, it's weird.
The communion
but I don't
thing?
Know.
Yeah, because, like, who would have known the communion picture unless you're suggesting it
was only 2 years ago.
I want to make sure.
Could have been Julie had some influence in that too. Julie recognized that that's how you're supposed to pray when you're dead, or when that's how you're supposed to look when you're praying or being holy. And maybe she wanted them to be posed that way.
I want to call attention to the bloody stone thing.
Yeah,
That leads me to believe that it may have been an accident.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Also, maybe the fact that they moved the body, and then really quick, just how upset Hayes got in the 2015 timeline when she did bring forward all this new information and bringing up the car, which he then had the flashback to the treads and remembered. So I think that is really important. There's a reason why he got upset, and there's a reason why she was pushing the way that she was. And I think that's why he said her name the way he did, because he could tell. It wasn't just like, oh, by the way, you missed this stuff. She was like, did you get everything?
Yeah.
Okay, you didn't get everything because you didn't get this. And they're like, whoa, 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 whoa.
So, Julia, let's just last, before we get to our prediction segment here, let's just talk about those notes. We find these notes in this book, and I wrote a couple of them down, right? One of them says,
it's all right, don't listen, I'll always keep you safe.
Or the yeah, ones it's okay, don't listen, I'll always keep you safe, and I'm always here is the last one I wrote down.
And then if you remember the note that was sent, with the letters, that said, do not worry, Julie is in a good place and safe, so I think this whole thing has been about Julie more than anything, about the little girl, and that the children should laugh.
So perhaps the person that wrote the note had a relationship already, and those notes were written to her by that person who maybe abducted her. Maybe it's less of an abduction than we think. It's culty stuff. That's probably a good time to get into predictions, actually. What does it all mean?
What does it all mean?
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Oh, I forgot about
and
predictions.
Now, you're After Buzz TV.
I literally started to expound on mine just now, so I'll just continue it.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I think it's that those notes have something to do with the note and the person that wrote the note, and I don't think it was an abduction as much as some sort of weird runaway with me cult thing. Because Dungeons and Dragons and the role-playing side of it, that's what feels like to me.
I get some of that too. I don't think it's going to be culty. I think it's going to be related to the family in some way. I don't know if like maybe it's a real mom or real parent or something trying to like lure them away from the family or something of that nature. I just feel like there's something up with the family. I think the D&D thing is going to play out some way. I'm not sure what. I'm also really curious about what was that place called? The Ozark Children's Outreach Center? Something.
Yeah. Yes,
I need to watch that scene again.
That.
There's something going on there.
For sure.
And also, like, this whole thing just stinks of cover-up. We keep hearing about people being talked to twice and information not being shared. We've already seen that they've been having issues coordinating with their higher-ups in the county and the FBI and all that stuff. So I'm just curious to see where that goes.
I'm kind of agree with what you're saying. I'm really suspicious about the Ozark Children's Outreach Center, how and the director harkened back to VIP pedophile rings, which, you know, could be pretty far stretched, but now the big VIP of Hoyt Foods is out on safari right. for Ooh. A long time. So I don't know how deep this goes or how long they've been targeting Julie since the mother did work there. So maybe they've had her eye on her and luring her for a while. I'm also really interested to find out how Amelia died.
Yeah, agreed.
Because that seemed to happen a while ago. They're not that old. So it's not of natural. I mean, it could be. Who knows?
Could
it
be.
Doesn't feel like it's, you know, of old age.
Flip up, what do you got?
All right, this is my bold prediction. I don't know enough about Eliza, the director of the documentary. I think Eliza might be Julie.
I had that thought, too.
I think the ages are right. I think the coloring's right. I think our girl Eliza...
It would be 25 years later.
Because her investment, and she would have been right in her mid-30s, seems about right. And her investment seems very, very personal.
Yeah,
like, intensely personal. So that would be my...
I like it.
That would be my... Is Eliza Julie?
Weirder things have happened.
Prediction. Guys, where can the folks find you?
Guys, you can find me everywhere. I talk like this. I went for it.
All right,
do it.
I like it. Twitter, Instagram, Julia Carolee, JULIACEARLEY.
And you can find me at Joe Filippo on the Twitters. My website is josephsanfilippo.com.
You guys can find me at Ben Bateman Media. We'll be back same time, same place next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for watching, guys.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Our founder, Kevin Undergaro, and me, Maria Menounos, would like to thank you for tuning in to AfterBuzz TV. Remember, we're not just the first, we're the biggest in the world, and we're the only destination for all your favorite TV shows. Whatever you crave, we've got it. So go to AfterBuzzTV.com and check out our lineup. Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.